This week, I want to move us on to a different plane altogether. We have thought very hard. Now, I want us to stop thinking, if that's possible, and move back in our perceptions to a place of quiet feeling. For a little while, no one is going to be asking anything of us, so we can simply enter into a space of not worrying about making up our minds about anything, deciding anything, meeting anyone's demands. We're going to try the opposite of the king's wish. We are going to try not to interfere, but simply to look at the world around us in order to understand better how to serve it. An early warning, this lecture will be more religious than last week's. A quotation from Simone Weil about attending on the needs of another is a good place to start, I suggest. Prayer, she said, was attention. And attention consists of suspending our thought, leaving it detached and ready to be penetrated by the object. Above all, our thought should be empty, waiting, not seeking anything, but ready to receive in its naked truth the object that is to penetrate it. The love of our neighbor in all its fullness simply means being able to say to him, "What are you going through?" This way of looking is first of all attentive. The soul empties itself of all its own contents in order to receive into itself the being it is looking at, just as he is, in all his truth. We are stepping back from the completely natural but also addictive human desire to pass everything through our hands, as the Orthodox theologian John Zizoulas writes, to mess around with the creation, turn it into things we can use, like clothes and books and televisions and great big abbey churches, helping elderly people across roads they may not want to traverse, changing policies, rearranging citizens' lives in order to feel that we are doing something useful or at any rate doing something, and so on. Tonight we are concerned with perception, attitude, empathy. I want to share four ways of looking at our feeling about the world taken from the treasury of the Judeo-Christian tradition. If they do to you what they did to me, they will shift perceptions in such a way that we can feel towards each other and the whole of the world and the earth such a connection and ultimately such a feeling of love that our behavior naturally follows a moral course, one that comes out of love. But as with last week, my aim is not to tell anyone what is the right thing to do. I want to show that how we feel towards something makes all the difference in the world to the way we treat it. The four perceptions are the covenant with creation, the sacrament of creation, the priesthood of humanity, and the Sabbath feast of enoughness. I am indebted to the Bishop of London, Dr. Richard Charters, for drawing my attention to these perceptions. They were used when I was supporting him in his role as the Church of England's lead bishop on the environment. However, please do not regard what I am about to say merely as an environmental manifesto. The perceptions provide an emotional atmosphere, an ethos within which robust moral decision-making can happen. In drawing back from the quotidian, we gain perspective. By seeing the size of the challenges to humanity, our daily dilemmas seem less significant, which is not at all the same as saying that they disappear. The famous philosophical puzzle applies. How do you make a line shorter without touching it. You make a line shorter without touching it by drawing a longer line next to it. The first perception is called the covenant with creation. This is the one God is said to have made after the flood, the Berith Olam, as it's called in Hebrew, the eternal covenant made not just with Noah and all humans, but with all creatures. This is a wondrous myth. The word for covenant, Berith, shares a root with the Hebrew word used exclusively for divine creativity in Genesis, bara. Bara conveys a sense of a web of interdependence, all things related to all things. Imagine a three-dimensional spider's web. Cut a thread here and a thread there, and the web survives. Cut several threads all at once, and the whole web collapses, not just a part of it. Hildegard of Bingen, a 13th century mystic, doctor of the church and musician, wrote, "God has made all things in the world in consideration of everything else." Evelyn Underhill, a 20th century mystic, wrote this exercise in her book Practical Mysticism, and we can try it as we read. Stretch out by a distinct act of loving will towards one of the myriad manifestations of life that surround you, and which, in an ordinary way, you hardly notice unless you happen to need them. Pour yourself out towards it. Do not draw its image to you. As to the object of contemplation, it matters little. From alp to insect, anything will do, provided that your attitude be right. For all things in this world towards which you are stretching out are linked together, and one truly apprehended will be the gateway to the rest. A subtle interpenetration of your spirit with the spirit of those unseen existences, now so deeply and thrillingly felt by you, will take place. Old barriers will vanish, and you will become aware that St. Francis was accurate as well as charming when he spoke of brother wind and sister water. 12 centuries or so after the Noah story of the Hebrew scriptures, the evolutionary biologist E.O. Wilson wrote of the extraordinary riot of biological diversity that makes up the complex ecosystems upon which all life depends. Pull out a flower from its crannied retreat. Shake the soil from the roots into your cupped hand. Magnify it for close examination. The black earth is alive with a riot of algae, fungi, nematodes, mites, springtails, enchytraid worms, thousands of species of bacteria. The handful may be only a tiny fragment of one ecosystem, but because of the genetic codes of its residents, it holds more order than can be found currently on the surface of all the planets combined. It is a sample of the living force that runs the Earth. It is diversity that makes all life possible, not just this or that species, but the glorious, extensive mix. Just as a diversity of species is needed to maintain life on the planet in response to various batterings, so is a diversity of human responses also needed to ensure the health of human communities. Cultural diversity is conducive to health and survival. It's contrary to disease and withering. As with a field whose soil goes sterile if the same crop is planted year after year, so with a community that never refreshes itself with the welcome addition of the stranger. James Lovelock provided a controversial paradigm, controversial both to scientists and to people of faith, when he suggested his Gaia hypothesis, in which we imagine the Earth, including humans, as a single living entity with all its parts dependent upon each other. Although we see the different parts of the Earth, and certainly ourselves, as separate from each other, it's not difficult to make this shift in our perception if we think of our own bodies by analogy. First, think of the air around us that we breathe in and out. Then the head, torso, arms and legs, hair, eyelashes, fingernails and toenails, skin, muscle and flesh under the skin, tendons, ligaments, and the skeleton to give structure, organs and fatty substance around them to protect them. Now, think of the Earth as a body. I draw on the writing of J.R. McNeill for this description. Think of the atmosphere around the Earth, at its outer edge, receiving and reflecting the all-important sun's rays, at its lowest altitudes, exchanging heat, moisture, and gases with soil, water, and living things. Think now of the pedosphere, the soil that lies on the outer crust of the Earth, like skin on flesh, about half a meter thick, made of sand, clay, silt, and organic matter, acting as a cleansing and protecting membrane between the lithosphere and the atmosphere. Now picture the lithosphere, the crust of the Earth, about 120 kilometers thick, rock floating on molten rock. On average, the Earth's rocks have eroded, deposited on ocean floors as sediment, consolidated into rock again, and been thrust up above sea level again 25 times in the history of the Earth. And think of the hydrosphere, the plumbing of this blue planet, which, like our bodies, is mostly water. Water flows in the rainfall, in rivers and oceans, in watersheds, in our drinking, our washing, and our tears. And finally, the biosphere, the sum of all the habitat in which species live, including every home in every part of the world, from the bubbling seafloor vents teeming with bacteria to glaciers at dizzy heights where the occasional beetle may be found, and everything in between. Images from outer space show us the exquisite beauty of this single entity. Once one has begun to think this way, seeing the undeniable dependence of everything upon everything else, it becomes harder to treat matter as inert and under the control of humans. The pre-lapsarian command to Adam was to till and keep the garden, to serve and conserve. And few farmers would now claim that they have control over the land that grows our crops. We ignore the rhythms of nature at our peril. There is no such thing as a post-agrarian society. Look at Easter Island. And as someone once said, humanity, despite its artistic pretensions, its sophistication, and its many accomplishments, owes its existence to a 6-inch layer of topsoil and the fact that it rains. That, then, is the perception of ourselves and the whole creation as bound together in a web of interdependence. We need beetles as much as we need bishops, possibly more so. The sacrament of creation is a way of expressing the intrinsic value of every nanometer, every minute movement in the world and of it. In the Christian tradition, we say that God sees and loves every part, and so we too do not simply dismiss any part or anyone as other. There is nowhere called away where we can throw things. None we can call other to treat merely as a means to our own ends. Descartes' famous and influential separation of mind and matter led to a profoundly held idea that, as he put it, humans are masters and possessors of the universe, and the universe is there for our use only. A Victorian explorer, a clergyman, expressed astonishment at discovering an exquisite orchid deep in the heart of the rainforest, where no human, as far as he knew, had ever penetrated. Why on earth had God put it there, he wondered. Of course, the Cartesian degrading of matter and the gloriously self-confident and arrogant attitude of our Victorian forebears made the Industrial Revolution possible, and who among us can deny the benefits that we all still know from that? But we and the Earth are paying some heavy prices now, and it's my contention that without an equally profound reorientation of our perceptions away from the idea that the Earth is a tool for human use, we will not find any lasting solution to the environmental crisis we now face. It's not just environmental, but human as well. The concepts of covenant and sacrament move us away from thinking there's work to do for the good of humanity and different work to do for the good of the natural world. And when they compete, since we're humans, we must obviously prioritize the good of humanity, sawing off the branch we are sitting on, as it were, because we need fuel. There has never been anyone like you before. And there will never be anyone like you ever again. You are, and always will be, unique. The same is true of every blade of grass. E.O. Wilson contends that we should value species as much as we value works of art, because they are both kinds of miracles born of a long, long history of development and struggle against the odds. Humans are not temporary tenants on an earth that is simply a backdrop for our merely human dramas or a bottomless larder of good things for us to consume. We did not land here from elsewhere and adapt. The rocks and we are as we are because we evolved together, which is why the idea, born of a continued Cartesian technological arrogance, that we can simply move to another planet when we finish trashing this one, is such a nonsense. It also explains why, for most of us, the natural world is experienced as restorative. The appreciation of the whole of creation as sacred is only really possible when one is not in a hurry. There's a wonderful analogy of the cross given by Evelyn Underhill, in which she writes of the horizontal bar being the journey through life, and the vertical bar being the present moment, always now, deeply now, in this place. Every footfall is now. And when one isn't in a hurry, one notices things. When rushing from A to B, whatever falls in one's path is an obstacle. When not rushing, it or they can become matters of great interest and respect. Thirdly, the priesthood of humanity considers the role of humans. In this worldview we are developing, which includes the whole riot of life, we could easily conclude, as some commentators have, that it would have been much better had the human race never evolved, since we seem, wherever we live, to have a destructive effect on biological diversity and the general health of the Earth. But we are here. And given that we are here, and that we care about each other, we should consider how we should be here. Let us, therefore, see ourselves neither as the summit of creation, nor as better off dead, but part of its interdependent web of life. Mary Oliver wrote, "You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert, repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things. What is our place? The Hebrew scriptures, echoed by Christology, speak of the human as prophet, priest, and king. The prophet is the seer. I enjoyed John Gray's rant in his Straw Dogs, in which he accuses Christianity first and then humanism for giving humans the notion that we are special, and points out all the trouble that has caused. John Gray suggests that our greatest gift to the universe, the part we should be playing, given all our talents and abilities, is simply to see. James Lovelock agrees. In his anthropomorphizing account of the Earth as Gaia, he points out that with the advent of the human species, she, Gaia, has at last been able to hold up a mirror to her face and see her own beauty in the images we have of the Earth from outer space. Humans, in James Lovelock's account, are the brain of Gaia. We should not underestimate the power of simply attending. This was Dame Cecily Saunders' great insight into treatment at the end of life, when there was nothing to be done and a life was simply ebbing away. Accompanying a person on that journey was the greatest service one could offer, and indeed a great privilege to perform. When asked what he was doing in a place, a monk simply said, "Keeping it." The priest acts. The priest in the Christian tradition takes things of the earth and through God's grace transforms them into the means of salvation. The offertory prayer in the Eucharist says this: "Blessed are you, Lord God of all creation. Through your goodness we have this bread to set before you, which earth has given and human hands have made. It will become for us the bread of life." The Eucharist gives a paradigm for humanity living rightly as guests at a feast, receiving gifts, not as rapacious bipeds claiming our right to satisfy our voracious appetites at the top of the food chain. Adam, we remember, in his pre-lapsarian state, was commanded to till and keep the earth, serve and conserve. The icon writer sees him or herself as taking the things of the earth, wood, egg tempura, gold, lapis lazuli, and transforming them into songs of praise of God. So might we consider how to act in a way that treats things and people with the utmost respect, wasting nothing, trying to leave things better than when we found them, and if we can't, leaving them alone. I think that this perception of humanity as priests in the web of life makes us stand straighter, look more directly, and asks us to join forces as a single human family with a single planet to share and therefore care for. Where does human conflict fit in this perception? In the light of bigger challenges, surely we would all be best served putting down our weapons and working out how to prevent desertification or flooding of much needed land. How much madder looks the madness of the scraps over scraps of land, whether in the Middle East, Eurasia, or Africa, when we think of the global challenges the whole of humanity and the rest of the living world is facing. The human as king. What does the king do? Some terrible consequences have come from the misuse, in my view, of the biblical idea of dominion, with our Victorian forebears thinking it was their God-given duty to exploit the creation which had been created for them to dominate. That's what it says in the first creation account in Genesis, after all. And the perception fits with the Cartesian notion of being masters and possessors. In the Christian mythos, counterculturally, the king is defenseless, vulnerable, and ultimately lets himself be killed, confounding any notion of domination. The fourth and final perception I want to share with you this evening is the Sabbath feast of enoughness. In the first creation myth in Genesis, despite that dominion word, humanity was not the crown of creation. The Sabbath was, the seventh day, in which God himself took a rest, and we do not imagine he did so because he was tired. Such a rest is to be offered not only to humans, but to all creation. Leaving land fallow, forgiving debts, and returning goods are all part of the Jubilee call to stop a while and be still. In the roaring voracity of desire that can so consume our waking hours and even our sleep in dreams, we are called to stop. Properly. For a period of time. Not just to pause for breath before carrying on consuming, but to take a deep dive into God's peace. D.H. Lawrence wrote, "I have been dipped again in God and new created." In the Hebrew scriptures, Sabbath is associated with atonement, at one meant. In stopping properly, one has time to notice that one's actions have consequences and be suitably penitent for any harm done, intended or mostly unintended. So to sum up, four perceptions have been offered from the Judeo-Christian treasury: the covenant of interdependence of all creation, the sacredness of all creation, the priesthood of humanity, and the Sabbath feast of enoughness. The covenant perception wakens in us a realization of our mutual dependence in a complex three-dimensional living web of interconnectedness. The sacrament perception dissolves the Cartesian notion of separation from and domination of an inert earth. We experience every footfall as being on sacred ground. We see no one we can dismiss as other, and nowhere called away where we can throw things. The priesthood perception makes us consider how, in the light of our interconnectedness, we humans could be and live in the world. And the Sabbath perception gives us permission to rest and simply see, but in that seeing, to become aware of the damage we have been involved in, just by virtue of being part of the human family, ignorantly plundering each other and the planet. Then comes penitence, atonement, and restoration. And while we are quietly sitting and contemplating, the earth has a rest from our endless meddling. As I said, these perceptions affected a kind of conversion on me. In my work on environmental ethics, they provided proved far more powerful than any injunction to act to save the planet. Why change light bulbs, particularly if it is expensive to do so, when one doesn't really see what difference it makes? Better to see, or rather feel, our interconnectedness, and then to act from that perception. But these are not merely a good set of feelings to evoke to make human beings behave better towards the environment. They change our human interactions as well by raising our gaze above and beyond the horizon and placing those interactions in a much bigger context. Moral courage in our emotions is the surrendering of a Cartesian idea of being masters and possessors of the universe, and instead, as Mary Oliver put it, taking our place in the family of things and bringing all our talent and wisdom and perception and love and enthusiasm and skill and science to addressing the global challenges of the day, not as godlike solvers, but with an attempt at atonement and restoration. So we leave things better than we found them, knowing more fully what better than should look like and for whom. This kind of moral courage in emotion allows for joined up thinking, the mindset to address the global challenges of climate change, sustainable development, trade, and finance, which are all connected. Then the three approaches of goal-based, duty-based, and right-based thinking can be brought into play, but in a much bigger, more joined up world than we had been aware of hitherto. And our diligence in thinking clearly and acting decisively is greater because we have emotional strength and therefore endurance. Moral courage in our emotions, which expands our worldview and makes us not only notice the global context of our decision making, but also prevents us from ignoring the globe because we have fallen in love with it and feel deeply connected to it, is challenging. If you are responsible for public service of just one country, you may argue, that is quite big enough, and one's protection of interests has to stop there. That is self-evidently true of any national government. Of course, its role is to look after the interests of the citizens of that country. But increasingly, the leadership that is needed goes beyond countries to climate change, sustainable development, the movement of peoples, trade, and finance. And whom do we have but our national leaders to address these problems? I think we can learn from national leaders in the past who have not only transcended national self-interest, but also, crucially, inspired their citizens to share their international vision. Jeffrey Sachs has written recently about the speech that JF Kennedy made after the Cuban Missile Crisis, showing how he shifted from being on the brink of blowing up the planet in 1962 to signing the Test Ban Treaty in 1963. In the speech, JF Kennedy speaks of common humanity and human beings' moral responsibility for each other. He sets a vision beyond the fixed horizons of the US people and shows the way to get there. So the vision is not just motherhood and apple pie, and people are both morally uplifted and given hope because they see the path to that place they, in their heart of hearts, long to reach. More recently, Christine Lagarde inspired her audience with a vision of human cooperation in the face of global challenges in the 2014 Dimbleby lecture. I see now Our public servants need to lift their gaze beyond national self-interest and show leadership in addressing the needs of the whole of humanity and the whole of the planet. They need to inspire hope in others by describing the paths to meeting those needs, and they need moral courage in starting along them. That journey, ladies and gentlemen, is the subject of my next lecture. This week, I should like to leave you with the image of the three-dimensional spider's web of interconnectedness in which every living thing participates. Cut a thread here and a thread there, the web survives. Cut too many threads at once, the whole web collapses. Often, it is artists who show us the way. Silenced by the impossibility of the task, full of doubt and uncertainty, unable to return to a smaller existence, but unable as yet to see how to function in this bigger world we have fallen in love with, we do well to listen to the artists. And so I leave you with this poem by Pablo Neruda, Keeping Quiet. Now, we will count to 12, and we will all keep still. For once, on the face of the earth, let's not speak in any language. Let's stop for 1 second and not move our arms so much. It would be an exotic movement, without rush, without engines. We would all be together in a sudden strangeness. Fishermen in the cold sea would not harm whales, and the man gathering salt would look at his hurt hands. Those who prepare green wars, wars with gas, wars with fire, victory with no survivors, would put on clean clothes and walk about with their brothers in the shade, doing nothing. What I want should not be confused with total inactivity. Life is what it is all about. I want no truck with death. If we were not so single-minded about keeping our lives moving and for once could do nothing, perhaps a huge silence might interrupt this sadness of never understanding ourselves and of threatening ourselves with death. Perhaps the earth can teach us, as when everything seems dead and later proves to be alive. Now, I'll count up to 12, and you keep quiet, and I will go. Thank you very much.